Good morning. Welcome to Radio Activity. I'm Rob Loray. Coming up today, we're going to look at the long history of corporations lying to the public about their products, and we'll talk with an attorney who's written a new book on the topic, and then later on we'll open up the phone lines. First, one listener comment that came in yesterday afternoon, shortly after 3 in the afternoon. Not sure why this caller was prompted to call us, but here's what one listener has said about WMNF. Listen up.
Be well, peace to you. What are you, an idiot? This whole situation here with you people down here is ridiculous. You have this stupid radio station. Who the hell do you people think you are telling us the 4 women and black people were able to do whatever? Bullshit. Okay, make America great again means that Obama destroyed America. And you people need to wake up to it. You voted for a man who is mentally challenged. Get a grip. You'll have anybody at the helm. Doesn't matter whether he knows where he's going or not. You're not intelligent enough to see it. Your personal feelings get in the way. Well, the reality is this country's better off now than it ever has been. But you want to talk about how we need to bring everything back. We need to, yeah, the swamp is back. Everybody gets a say. No, that's not the way things work in life.
Well, that was a listener comment that ended up in our inbox yesterday afternoon around 3 o'clock. Not sure what set that listener off. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. We always encourage listeners to call us up and comment about the topics that we're talking about. First up today, we're going to talk with Barbara Fries, who is the author of several books, including Coal, A Human History. She's a former Minnesota Assistant Attorney General. She's written a new book called Industrial Strength Denial, 8 Stories of Corporations Defending the Indefensible. And she looks at institutions like slavery. She also looks at tobacco and auto safety and leaded gas and global warming and radium. And she recounts what corporations said to defend each of these. I spoke with Barbara Fries earlier today about her book, Industrial Strength Denial, and here is that interview. Barbara Fries, welcome to WMNF. Thank you for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
So why did you write the book, Industrial Strength Denial?
Well, I'm an environmental attorney. And it all really started for me with confronting climate denial, and it goes back really to the mid-90s. I was an assistant attorney general in Minnesota. We had a proceeding where we were trying to quantify the environmental impact of generating electricity. And so we looked at coal, where we got most of our electricity back then, and we looked at climate change. And the coal industry was not happy with that and sent a bunch of scientists to Minnesota to testify that we did not need to worry about climate change because it wasn't going to happen, or we were going to like it, or in fact it would be good for us. And all of those scientists that the rest of the world was relying on already by then, who were warning that this was a serious problem, that they were biased. And so it was pretty shocking. And then for decades after that, I saw this line of attack, this line of denial, spreading through society, from right-wing activist groups to right-wing media to really the entire Republican Party. And I looked at that and I thought, this is a very powerful phenomenon, and I'd like to know how other societies confronted it, how other industries handled evidence that they were causing harm, and how societies overcame that denial to the extent that they did. And so I dug into the archives and came up with these 8 particular stories.
Just getting back to coal for a moment, did a coal executive once tell you that coal dust in the lungs was actually good for you?
Well, this was actually a historical quote that I put in my first book, because after I confronted the coal industry, I wrote a book called Coal, A Human History. And that includes a quote from a coal merchant from earlier in the 1900s, as I recall, saying that, yeah, having coal in your lungs actually filters the air as it enters your bloodstream, kind of like a carbon filter. So that was one of the more amazing historical quotes. And it was the experience of looking at that history of coal that made me understand that you really can find fascinating histories in the historical archives that have lessons for the issues we're facing today.
One of the issues you start with is slavery, and you go back and look at the claims made by slave traders in the 1700s about why the slave trade was good. What audience were they aiming their message at?
Well, this was the British slave trade. Britain actually dominated the transatlantic slave trade in the late 1700s, early 1800s. And so they were aiming at the British public because they were facing a pretty impressive abolition movement back then that was arguing that slavery is brutal and had a lot of evidence to support that. So they responded, and because the British public knew nothing about slavery, it was just too far away, they could say whatever they wanted. And what they said basically was that they were rescuing these Africans from a worse fate in Africa, that they wanted to be purchased and tried to even market themselves, that they had a festive crossing on the slave ship across the Atlantic and basically ended up in this extremely comfortable, you know, plantation life,
wait a minute. Festive crossing?
Yeah, they argued that there was a lot of singing and dancing and games of chance, and they gave the women little beads to make crafts with, and that they had, you know, better food and drink than they could have had at home. It was absolutely appalling. And of course, anybody who had ever been on a slave ship knew how ridiculous that was.
Mm. And how did they get the word out? And what was the, today we've got social media and we've got radio and TV and cable. How did they get the word out back then in the 1700s?
They wrote short books and pamphlets. And so it's all in writing. And they distributed it. We also have testimony before government committees and parliament, which was written down as fast as possible by people then and published. So there's actually quite a lot of evidence of their denial. We know exactly the words they used and the excuses they used, and I quote liberally from them.
Several of these battles a lot of our listeners have lived through, like tobacco and car safety and leaded gas. And we know today cars are safer than they were in the 1950s and early 1960s before seatbelts and before headrests. When it comes to requiring safety features on cars, what were the arguments put up by car manufacturers in the 1960s not to do it?
Well, the main strategy they used, and this lasted for decades, was to keep the focus on the driver and in that way keep the focus on not the cause of the injury, but the cause of the accident, because those were two separate things. You could get into an accident and not be badly hurt if you were in a crash-worthy car, of course. But if you focused on what caused the injury, then you could easily blame the drivers. And, of course, there were bad drivers out there. And in that way, they would basically say, hey, you know, you're not supposed to crash your car, and so therefore we don't have to build a car that is crash-worthy. That was a general approach. And then they had more specific kind of factual denials, like the chief safety engineer for GM in the 1950s would argue that there just really wasn't any evidence that seatbelts would help and they might very well hurt you. And, you know, this was coming from an industry that was really considered the largest industrial enterprise in the world at the time with enormous resources. They could have found out whether seatbelts worked or not, and instead they left it to others to do the experimentation and then to have to convince them that seatbelts were really a critical safety advance.
Did you look at the numbers in terms of people surviving crashes and the number of deaths before seatbelts and headrests and the number of deaths after seatbelts and headrests?
Right, yes. And I've got those in the book. They would go up and up and up in the tens of thousands. I think we reached about I may have this number wrong now, around 50,000 around the time that we started finally regulating autos on a federal level. And then they started to gradually go down. I think now they're closer to the 30,000. But given the incredible increase in driving and miles driven, basically those who have looked at these numbers have calculated that the safety advances put in place by regulation have saved hundreds of thousands of lives.
Well, we're talking with Barbara Fries. She's the author of a new book called Industrial Strength Denial, Eight Stories of Corporations Defending the Indefensible, and this is WMNF in Tampa. Barbara, there's a famous quote from Upton Sinclair, the author and politician, activist, and the quote is, "It's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it." It's one of my favorite quotes, but I'm just wondering, these corporate spokespeople that say things that ultimately turn out not to be true, are they doing it because they believe what they say, or are they doing it because they're getting a paycheck?
Oh, yeah, that, of course, is a huge question, and it was one that I decided if I was going to try to distinguish between, you know, people who are consciously lying and those who believe what they say, that this book would be impossible to write. So I tried to leave it in almost all cases to the readers to decide. I do think it's very much a mix. There's no question that the money is a big factor. And Upton Sinclair was totally right about that. But, you know, as with traditional economics, there's a lot more to it than just seeing human beings as profit-driven. We are social creatures. And when you start looking at that aspect of our personalities, you see the importance of tribalism, of social norms, of ideology, of all kinds of other social signals that we're getting and giving to others. And all of those things can combine to allow us to deceive ourselves. So I try not to underestimate the power of self-deception and not to underestimate the power of overt deception. I think they are both very powerful forces, and they are things that make corporate denial really predictable and really powerful.
Until recently, the cigar and tobacco industry put up quite a fight. They had their own nonprofit group that was sent out to radio talk shows and TV talk shows to defend the safety of cigarettes. This was a battle that went on from the 1950s and 60s right up into the 1980s and early 1990s. Talk about how the tobacco industry fought back against safety concerns.
Well, it did it in so many ways. And of course, it helped that a very huge percentage of the people who were listening were, in fact, addicted to nicotine and really wanted to believe what they were hearing. Tobacco did it largely at first by focusing on the burden of proof, arguing that there was no proof that tobacco caused, lung cancer was the main thing that they were concerned about at first. Statistically, the odds that everybody who got lung cancer would have been a smoker, and that was pretty much true, was like 1 million to 1. So they had to come up with alternative explanations for the lung cancer epidemic. They pointed to genetics, arguing that there was something perhaps in the genes or personality that made people both want to smoke and be prone to lung cancer. A lot of times they would rely on these sort of counterfactuals where they would say, look, if you didn't smoke, you would do something worse. I begin the book with a quote from the head of Philip Morris saying, you know, who knows what you would do if you didn't smoke cigarettes? You might beat your wife. You might drive cars fast. They defended basically that they were arguing that they were defending freedom and personal responsibility. They criticized their opponents as really fascists. And they also did their best to undermine faith in government. And I think this is a really important thing to think about right now as we have reached such new levels of low social trust in our country. For example, in 1986, the Tobacco Institute argued that the Surgeon General should be investigated for abuse of science and argued that scientific integrity was at stake. And I think this was really an early salvo in a fight that went on then for decades, not just from the tobacco industry, but they basically helped set up all of these little groups, think tanks, advocacy groups that would get lots of money from various industries, and that argued that every time the government wanted to regulate something based on science, it was junk science. So you couldn't trust the government, you couldn't trust science. Eventually, of course, this would move on so that you couldn't trust mainstream media, you couldn't trust, well, now, of course, the argument of those taking up these claims is you can't trust elections. So I don't want to make too much of the connection between industrial strength denial and where we are today, but I do think that decades of corporations telling us that you can ignore evidence, that you don't need evidence to make accusations, and that you cannot trust experts or government or science has had an effect. It has made us very vulnerable, and I think it contributes to where we are now.
Well, we're talking about the book Industrial Strength Denial with its author, Barbara Fries, and you're listening to WMNF 88.5 FM. So, Barbara, what caused the defense of tobacco to collapse? Because now I think that there is a consensus in the country that cigarettes do kill, even though a lot of people still smoke cigarettes. But there is a consensus that it's not good for you. Doctors don't recommend cigarettes as they did in the ads of the 1950s. Was there something that caused the dam to break?
I think it was decades of effort from many different directions, starting, of course, with the doctors and the scientists, and then the government picking it up with the Surgeon General's report in 1964, and then various states trying to put in place laws that were, you know, trying to limit this. Then, of course, in the 90s, there were the lawsuits. For decades and decades, the industry had successfully defended itself against lawsuits. Then there were big lawsuits from the states, from all of the states. Minnesota played a major role in this, where I'm from. And that then also helped release all kinds of background documents through discovery that showed just how much the industry knew and how they were cynically manipulating the public and the government. I think that really changed public opinion about the tobacco industry. There was also a federal case brought against them under the RICO Act. And then I think what happened was, it was the industry denying this for decades, the industry at the same time claiming that if they really believed they were killing people, they would stop selling their product. By the 1990s, they realized they didn't need to make that claim. And they started to admit, yeah, of course we continue to sell our product. Now the tobacco industry admits that their product is addictive and that it kills people. But of course, they still want to sell as much of it as they possibly can. So they basically put in place all these barriers to regulation, and they benefited from them for a long time. To some extent, they still are. But ultimately realized that they had, I think, overcome the social norm that says you shouldn't sell deadly products, and decided that they didn't need to deny it anymore. They could continue to sell their product even while admitting it was a problem. Now, smoking has gone down. I think that is largely because social norms have changed, and by that I mean both the laws and just our customs and expectations, and that happened very slowly over the decades thanks to the work of a whole lot of people.
It's interesting that in your book, science and regulations and trial lawyers and consumer activism and labor activism, they push back against these corporations. These are all the targets of the conservative movement today. The conservative movement doesn't like regulations or trial lawyers or science or, you know, activism. But yet,
right,
this was what the bulwark was against the corporate propaganda.
Yeah, and that is one of the troubling trends that sort of appear over the last few decades. I mean, we've seen corporate power pushed back against by all of these different segments of our society. And this has happened, you know, again and again historically, sometimes through large waves where you see corporate power really being pushed back a lot. But I would say since, you know, probably 1980 with the election of Reagan and beyond, We haven't seen that continued pushback. We've seen corporate power rising and rising, and that is what is very troubling. My hope is that we're maybe on the cusp of seeing another era where corporate power generally is pushed back against successfully, and that power over our democracy is reduced. But you know, we'll see. Certainly, the era of Citizens United and Trump has been quite alarming. But maybe now things will shift. Certainly, the effort to convince the public that you can trust markets to handle everything has not been successful with people under 30. So I think demographically we're seeing that, you know, there really is a lot of suspicion about corporate power and a desire to reduce it. And fingers crossed, we'll get there.
Barbara, one last area I want to bring up before I let you go, and that is global warming. We're still in debate about global warming. There's some people that say, well, carbon dioxide is good. You'll have more plants. You'll have more green stuff on the earth. There are people saying, well, I like warmer temperatures because I can stay. It's warmer in upstate New York, or it's warmer in Ohio or Minnesota. I have a longer growing season. And there's people that say there's no evidence because scientists have been claiming there's going to be a global ice age, and that turned out not to be true. And now, you know, scientists are saying, well, global warming is a problem. And the skeptics say, well, look, you can't trust scientists because they've been on both sides of the issue. So where are we at in the debate with corporations over global warming?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. I do try to trace some of how that debate has evolved over the last few decades. Right now, when it comes to folks like, say, ExxonMobil, I mean, the big oil companies, they no longer make those claims at all. I mean, they've basically gotten to the point, kind of like the tobacco industry, where they admit the basic scientific facts, but they're still trying very aggressively to sell as much of their product as possible. So, yeah, you're still going to hear some of that denial. It has actually declined a bit over the last few years. And fortunately, we've seen the climate alarm, the very well-supported climate alarm, growing, both within the Democratic Party and to a lesser extent within the Republican Party. So, yeah, I mean, it's been ridiculous to see this denial blossom and spread over the last few decades. We are seeing it decline now, and unfortunately, it's put us decades behind in aggressively attacking this problem. But I do think that certainly we're going to see so much more action during the Biden administration, and instead of seeing, well, I'm assuming, of course, that everything works out all right here. But, you know, we've seen things go back so badly over during the Trump administration, and fortunately that appears now to be coming to an end. Denial has played a huge role. I think that of all of the campaigns I've looked at, climate denial has been the most successful. And given that it poses a threat of global catastrophe, the most dangerous.
Barbara, I see a lot of ads by corporations on television telling us what good folks they are. And, you know, the corporation might say, well, we're concerned about global warming, or we're concerned about neighborhoods or small businesses. Or McDonald's has this ad campaign in which it suggests that all of its workers are going to get into college somehow. And, you know, that the McDonald's job is just a stepping stone, and that everybody works at McDonald's for a year or two, but then moves on to something else. I see Walmart advertising that it buys local goods, even though the last time I was in Walmart, almost every label was from China. So when we see corporations pushing back, claiming to be good citizens, what do you think's going on?
Well, I have sort of mixed feelings about that, because at least those corporations are accepting that they have some kind of social responsibility and are trying to show that they're going to live up to that. I'm more worried about the companies and the market ideology that suggests corporations have no social responsibility. But obviously, the companies that make those claims have to be held to those claims, and you want to dig into it, because there's enormous opportunity for greenwashing and hypocrisy. So it all kind of comes down to whether they live up to their promises, or how their claims compare to the other things that they're doing at that time.
Barbara, if you were to offer advice to people about how to suss out industrial strength denial in some new area, if you were to say, be careful of the claims by this corporation in this area, what would you point to that might be a current example that's been underreported?
Well, I mean, generally speaking, I think you need to recognize that there's going to be enormous bias. I suppose most people already do recognize that. I think accepting that there's going to be, that there needs to be independent outside expertise looking at these issues and really focusing on the evidence is critical. I think patience is critical when it comes to a lot of the scientific questions because, of course, they evolve over time. I think it's really important to recognize, though, that when the government finally gets around to regulating something, it is doing so based on a lot of evidence and facing a lot of pushback from the industries in question, and it's usually gone through lots of review by lots of independent experts and often courts as well. So if you have to decide between accepting the scientific claims of an industry defending itself and accepting the scientific claims of government trying to regulate that industry, I would absolutely go with the government.
Well, Barbara Fries, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF. Before I let you go, is there anything else you'd like to point out that we should have talked about, an important issue that you'd like to let our listeners know about?
Well, I guess I just want to make a general point here about social trust. I mean, I sort of complained earlier about how corporate denial has undermined social trust in so many of the institutions that we once turned to help us distinguish reality from fiction. To some extent, I realize I'm undermining trust in corporations simply by pointing out all of these areas of denial. But I think the important thing here is to remember the importance of evidence. And that is the difference. And also whether or not you're actually trying to improve the institutions that you're complaining about or just trying to tear them down. I do feel like the right wing in our country is simply trying to undermine government and media and expertise and now, of course, elections. And to do that without evidence, I think, is incredibly cynical and incredibly dangerous.
Barbara Fries, thank you for coming on WMNF.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
That's Barbara Fries. She's the author of a brand new book called Industrial Strength Denial, 8 Stories of Corporations Defending the Indefensible. She looks back at things like slavery and tobacco and car safety and leaded gasoline, also radium, which was widely used, especially in watches. She's an environmental attorney and a former Minnesota Assistant Attorney General. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. If you've got an example, too, of maybe a corporation that's misled us Barbara and I didn't talk about, you can email us in the studio. The address is dj@wmnf.org. That's dj@wmnf.org. Or if you want to comment about anything you've heard here so far or will hear, you can call us up at 813-239-9663. I'm going to mention some news stories that are going on right now, and then we'll see where listeners want to take the conversation, and we'll see if anybody writes in. I'm looking for that first email on the topic of industrial strength lying or denial, the stories of corporations defending the indefensible. Lots going on out there. President Trump has fired the nation's top election security official, a widely respected member of his own administration who had dared to disagree with the president's unsubstantiated claims of electoral voting fraud. The director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, Christopher Krebs, was abrupt, but not dismissal was abrupt, but not a surprise to him. Since his loss to Democrat Joe Biden, Trump has been ridding his administration of officials who are seen as insufficiently loyal. And the president has been denouncing how the election was conducted. Krebs has been issuing a stream of statements and tweets over the past week attesting to the proper conduct of the election, saying it was fair. And so the president disagrees with him. Rudy Giuliani showed some rust returning to a courtroom, a federal courtroom, as an attorney yesterday for the first time in decades as he tries to make a stand in Pennsylvania for President Trump. During several hours of arguments in a Williamsport federal courtroom, this is in northeastern Pennsylvania, Giuliani threw around unsupported accusations about a nationwide conspiracy by Democrats to steal the election from Trump. No such evidence has emerged so far. Withering questions from the judge gave Trump's opponents hope that the lawsuit will be tossed out of court. We'll see what's going on. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. And let's go to Michael, who's in St. Petersburg. Hey, Michael, you're on MNF. What would you like to talk about today?
I just wanted to mention, you wanted to talk about another corporation or industry that didn't do something and then denied about it.
Well, the interview with the author, she was talking about all the cases where corporations lied about something for years to try to maintain their business, like the cigarette industry.
I have a big one. The airplane industry for years said it was too expensive to put locks on the pilot's doors. And they fought that for years and years until 9/11. If they'd have done that, there never would have been 9/11 or a different kind of 9/11. I don't know, but...
Well, that's a good point. I didn't realize that they fought it for years and years. I know that there were hijackings of airplanes going back, to the 1960s. But the industry actually fought that, huh?
They fought it aggressively. They said it was just too expensive to put locks on the doors. Just too expensive. The same thing the automobile industry, they said about seatbelts. Oh, it's just too expensive.
Yeah. All right. Well, Michael, good point. Thanks a lot. Thanks for calling in. And let's go to Don in Port Richey. Hey, Don, you're on MNF. What's up?
John, but that's...
Oh, fine. I'm sorry. John, go ahead.
That's fine. I would have liked to ask your guest a question about... she mentioned that the institutions, I don't know if she was saying the auto institution or the tobacco institution, how they set up like think tanks basically to... or pseudoscience places to undermine...
Yeah, I said they set up a nonprofit. It was called the Tobacco Institute.
Right. Well, I was wondering if there's a correlation to, like, those people that... or those institutions there, are they any way related to the same institutions today that are doing the climate denial? You know what I mean?
I think they use the same techniques. I don't know if it's a... I don't think it's the same nonprofit, but they use the same techniques.
Well, the backers. Like, maybe the you know, you could say, well, the Koch brothers did this, and then the Koch brothers did that. I don't know. But something else I was thinking about, too, is this fake news. And, man, I just think I'm going to become a conservative because it's so much easier to just in the mindset to be a conservative. Because I went back and I was thinking about this whole, like, people calling and they go, look at the fake news with the Russian collusion. There was no evidence, so it's fake news. Then they turn around and they go, there's election fraud without any evidence. Well, isn't that fake news because you're claiming something without evidence, just like the Russian collusion in your mind was fake news because there was no evidence?
Well, I think what they do is they look at that label on Fox News and they say, well, this is news, even though it's not.
Right.
And then they say, well, I saw it on the news, and therefore it must be true. Or they heard it on Rush Limbaugh, and because it's on the radio and somehow it's a white male voice, it must be news.
Yes, and they don't understand that it's opinion. And I've given example after example after example of where they have misled their audience. Now, I can't say it's intentional, even though I believe it's intentional. I can't prove it's intentional or how they contradict themselves all the time. But yet, they're a trusted source of information. Boggles my brain, Rob. Thanks.
All right, John, thanks a lot. Thanks. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Somebody named Hemp, I suspect that's not his or her real name, but they say, here are two examples of corporations lying, Monsanto and Bayer, and genetically modified foods. That's what they write. That's all they wrote, too. All right, thank you, Hemp. And then David writes this, I'm tired of the greenwashing ads from Mosaic and from Nestle Waters that run on Tampa Bay TV stations. I would love to see the Sierra Club run ads that show the true environmental degradation caused by these companies. Yeah, it's a really good example. I talked about Walmart and McDonald's, but those are two really good local examples where the corporation, Mosaic, or the corporation Nestle, they're not trying to sell you phosphate or sell you bottled water. They're trying to say, we're good corporate citizens. And I think the reality is that that's highly debatable. For instance, Nestle takes groundwater from Florida and then sells it. And takes the groundwater pretty much for free. You know, if you were extracting gold from a mountain in a progressive state, you would have an extraction fee to pay. And because the gold in that mountain belongs to the people of that state, the state says, well, you know, you're taking something that was gifted to us by nature, and so therefore we're going to charge you for taking that out of the ground. It happens in coal country too, although the extraction fees I don't think really measure up to the amount of environmental or human damage that's caused by the coal industry. But that typically is what happens. But in Florida, we don't charge an extraction fee for each ounce or each gallon of water that they extract, even though this is pure water given to us by nature. It belongs to all of us here in Florida. But because Nestle's has a permit, it's able to extract it without paying an extraction fee. So it doesn't give back to Florida, yet we know how precious groundwater is. 813-239-9663, email address dj@wmnf.org. Ernie writes this, when I joined the Army in 1968 in basic training and later in advanced individual training, the barracks were distinguished by red butt cans nailed to the wood posts. Cigarettes were extremely cheap. Smoking was encouraged. In this way, tobacco companies were insured of customers being addicts for life. I am one, writes Ernie in Port Richey. Yeah, my dad brought home from World War II one of his meal kits and kept it for years and years. I don't think it exists anymore. It was a ration kit, but in it was a can of tuna, some crackers, but one of the items in it was a small, like a 6 or 8 pack of cigarettes. So that was considered essential to soldiers back then. Good way to get them addicted back then, too. 813-239-9663. Kevin writes this. Ralph Nader said the Corvair was unsafe, but it took a while before GM pulled the car from production. Same thing about seatbelts. Consumer Reports has been standing up for consumers for more than 60 years, writes Kevin. Jessica Green is our phone producer today, and we started the show with an interview about all the times that corporations misled us. Let's go to Neville in Trinity. Hi, Neville. You're on M&F. Thanks for calling. What's up?
I was listening to your discussion about Mosaic. Mosaic used to be called Cargill. They keep changing their name because of their breaches of the environment. Cargill's the one that the sludge ran out of Mulberry and killed the Peace River. I don't know if you remember that or not.
Oh, yeah, we covered it. We've covered phosphate pretty well here, I think, on this radio station for 42 years.
Here's something that I happen to notice, which is an incredible anomaly. On the side of Tampa Bay, there is a processing plant, now Mosaic. It's a mountain of pollution just waiting to go into the bay. I cannot believe that they put that there. It's a good 500 to 1,000 feet high. I mean, it's a very large mountain of pollutants. Recently, I noticed they covered it with some kind of tarp because I guess it's running into the bay. But if you'll look at that, all we need is one hurricane, which is kind of rare on this coast, but one hurricane and that whole pile of sludge and, well, it's the contaminants are uranium, you name it. Everything that could be nasty is in that pile. It ends up in the bay, and of course, after the tide goes out, the whole coastline's gone. So, at any rate, that's just something I happened to notice, and no one seems to discuss that. That's something that needs to be dealt with, actually.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. Neville, thanks a lot. Yeah, the phosphate tailing mountains, and I think there's 18 or 20 of them here in Central Florida, are no person's land. They contain acid and residue from the phosphate mining. That includes, as you said, Neville, radioactive material. Yeah, there it's quite a problem, and they're a scar on the countryside. They're a scar in the landscape of Florida. I agree. And they're potentially in several breach, but they're dangerous. There was one that breached a few years ago. Didn't breach, but there was a sinkhole that developed under it. And all this toxic stuff that was at the top of the toxic mountain went into the groundwater. So what does that do to our groundwater supplies here? It's a really good question, Neville, and I think it's an important one. I promise the radio station is going to continue to pay attention to that, too. Let's go to Sharon in St. Petersburg. Hey, Sharon, what's up?
Hi, good morning, Rob. First of all, I wanted to say that I started smoking in the 70s because I had a job at Publix in a shopping center. And they passed out these little packets of cigarettes that had four cigarettes in them.
Publix did to you? Publix gave them to you?
No, not at Publix, but in the shopping area, you know.
They were just freebies being handed out by...
Correct.
Yeah.
Whoever,
kind of public relations people. Yeah. Those people used to roam the streets of downtown Tampa for years. They gave away free packs of cigarettes in downtown Tampa for years.
These had just like four in a pack. But it was enough to get you addicted when you're a teenager, you know, going to your teenager job as a cashier. And anyway, we're non-smokers now, but that's what got us hooked. And another thing I wanted to mention was, is there a reason why we can't call regulations protection?
Yeah, regulations have become a dirty word, haven't they?
Well, yes, because certain people use it that way. But if we call them protection, people might not feel so negative toward them. That's all I'm...
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because oftentimes you're right. I mean, there's a regulation that we have seatbelts in cars. You can't sell a car in the U.S. without having seatbelts and without also having head restraints. Headrests. Both of them protect us, and both of them are there by regulation. But yet, you know, you see these ads all the time from politicians who say, well, we don't want any regulations. Well, tell us which regulations you would like to do away with. Do you want to do away with the auto safety regulations? Do you want to do with the air pollution control regulations? Do you want to do away with the water purity and water quality regulations? Which regulations don't you like? That's a good point, Sharon. Thanks a lot. 813-239-9663. Jackie in Queensbury, New York writes, another example of industrial strength denial is certain medical products, with a glaring one being the IUD, which early on injured a lot of women. Women's contraceptive products, including the pill, have histories of being sold as safe when they certainly were not. Interesting that there's been much less research on male contraceptives, writes Jackie in Queensbury. Jackie, thank you for that. 813-239-9663. Email address dj@wmnf.org. Let's go to Janet in Gulfport. Janet, how are you?
Good. It's Jeanette.
No, I'm sorry, Jeanette. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I just wanted to agree with you about Mosaic and Nestle, how bad they are for our environment. And I wanted to mention that your sister station, WNPR or WSF, I'm not sure which one's your sister station, frequently advertises for Mosaic.
Yeah, they have underwriting. So I don't get a chance to listen to USF as much as I used to. Do they cover the phosphate issue, or do they not cover the phosphate issue?
No, Mosaic just advertised.
No, I'm wondering in their news segment.
Oh, I've never heard them ever cover anything, because I'm sure that they, you know, if they're a corporate sponsor for the radio station, why would they put anything negative out about them?
All right, Jeanette, thanks a lot. Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Bob in Odessa. Hi, Bob. You're on MNF. What's up?
Hi, Rob. Nestle is they're an easy target, but put into perspective, the Anheuser-Busch plant in Jacksonville is permitted 6 million gallons a day. Mosaic is permitted to draw 20 million gallons per day, straight out of the aquifer. Nestle, the one that everybody's been fighting lately, is permitted just over 1 million gallons per day. Now, there are golf courses, agriculture, soda bottling plants that use as much or much more on a daily basis that just seem to get a pass. All you have to do is go to your local grocery store, look down the soda and beer aisle, and then look at the bottled water aisle. And, you know, then you'll really see where all the water is.
Well, maybe a better way to look at it then is, shouldn't we be charging all these corporations by the gallon for extraction of this pure drinking water that we have in our groundwater? I mean, in the aquifer, rather. Shouldn't they pay a price to extract what is some of the purest water on the planet?
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. You know, the average consumer in their home pays for water. Now, most of that is, you know, the transmission of water, the filtering of water. But, you know, we don't get it free unless you dig your own well. You know, if people are going to bash Nestle, do it for, you know, their ridiculous use of single-use plastic bottles more than maybe just the water. But, you know, that's just trying to put things into perspective.
Okay, well, I think it's important to get the big perspective. So, Bob, thanks a lot.
All right.
Great to hear from you. I just looked up an article, and this is old. This is from July of 2013, written by the then environmental reporter at the Tampa Bay Times, Craig Pittman. The article says, last year, a state water agency granted the world's largest phosphate mining company a permit to pump up to 70 million gallons of water a day out of the ground for the next 20 years. Some of those millions of gallons of water, no one can say how much, is being used by the phosphate giant known as Mosaic to dilute polluted waste so it can be dumped into creeks without violating state regulations. So you can look that up. So I think Bob's point, I think he said 60 million gallons. I think they have a permit. Mosaic has a permit to pump up to 70 million gallons of water a day out of the ground. And you can look that up. It's on the Tampa Bay Times website, July 20th, 2013, by Craig Pittman. 813-239-9663 is our phone number. David writes this, when you're heading south in Hillsborough County on U.S. 41 south of Madison Avenue, it's amazing to see that gypsum stack just east of the highway is growing and very active. I wonder when or if it will ever be capped off, and how about health and safety for those who live nearby? David, thank you for that. Well, we've been talking about corporations not telling the truth, and our phone number is 813-239-9663. We got one open line. You'll be able to get through right away if you've got something to share. Let's go to Jared in St. Pete. Hey, Jared, you're on M&F.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. A couple things. My stepfather told me when he was in the Navy during Vietnam, the only way he could get a break, a 15-minute break from the duty that he was on, was if he was a smoker. So that obviously started his addiction. The other thing I'd like to bring up is, since we're talking about big corporations that do nasty things, let's talk about the pharmaceutical company who addicted millions, if I don't know if it's millions or not, but a whole lot of people, killed a whole lot of people with their opiate pills, OxyContin specifically, and I believe they paid I don't know the numbers, I know they paid millions if not billions of dollars in fines for lying to the federal government about their product being non-addictive, but that product alone has cost this country thousands upon thousands upon thousands of lives to be lost and families to be destroyed. So that's really my only point, Rob. Thanks.
All right, Jared, thanks a lot. Yeah, you know, I've been trying to do an interview with a trial lawyer in North Florida who's been suing the giant opioid companies, drug companies. And, I think much of what you say is true. I think a lot of people are concerned that nobody went to jail over all those opioid deaths. Let's go to Ron in Mango. Hey, Ron, you're on M&F. Thanks for calling. What's up?
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
hanging in, man. That's about it. I was listening, as I always be listening. Most of the guys, I'm a good listener, but the last guy back, the soccer guy was vape cigarette or beer to the extraction and theft of water. You don't have to have beer, but you have to have water to live. And if somebody takes for free that belongs to the residents of the state of Florida, that should be the biggest lawsuit ever. Especially Morgan and Morgan and all the other stuff they're doing, they should be jumping on that, because I'm going to show you two things. One is that it's hypocritical to tell people you can't help them socially, but you can let a corporation who's supposed to be a person now, one person, steal from everybody. Okay? That paradigm still changed some years ago. So corporations are now acting as though they're people. You say it yourself. And then they're acting like people are not people. So that's really a messed up paradigm shift, and that has to be dealt with there. And I think people need to deal with that instead of talking about it and let them steal our water. And the other thing is paying for water. Water is free gift. And then when I grew up, you pulled it out of a well on my granddaddy's farm in a bucket. And then you dipped it out and drank it, and it was free to anybody who drilled it themselves for their family and you know, the residents, I guess. So during that era, you might not remember this, but I remember that they had white drinking fountains only, okay? This relates to the topic the lady was just talking about, the nice lady who laid out that program. I think that they did that absolutely on purpose, because once they made it that everybody could drink out of the same drinking fountain, some people were still sick like they are today about politics, okay? And that's why that happened, I think, and that's why we're losing our water, because of that same little bitty premise that some people didn't deserve to drink out of a water fountain. Okay? So now we don't deserve to have water as a whole. And that's really alarming to me. And that's all I want to say. And that's a real hypocritic thing when you have people saying cut social programs and take away from them, and you can just take from the earth and pollute our planet with all.
Yeah, it is a giant social program for all those beer companies and water companies and phosphate companies, exactly, that are extracting the water for free. Yep.
Exactly.
Ron, thanks a lot. Thank you. As always. All right.
Thank you for the topic, Ron.
Thank you. Let's go to Chris in Sarasota. Hey, Chris, you're on WMNF. What would you like to say?
Hi. Thank you, Rob. Let's see. I've been on several protests at the Mantee County Chamber with Andy Mele, who's the waterkeeper person. Anyhow, what they do is they stack the chamber with their green-shirted crane operators, dredging, and the dredging operates 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, nonstop. And they give Manatee County all kinds of money. You know, they just redid the planetarium. The whole waterfront, everything's got mosaic on it. And they just bend over and let them, you know, do what they want. It's just kind of like one of the...
Well, Chris, tell our audience why you protest phosphate mining in Manatee County. Why are you posting?
Destroying the environment and the water, you know, because it's all... Everything washes out to the sea, and what they're doing is all of that. The other thing was, you know, the big, tall gypsum plant, stacks. There's been a couple of them that have opened up to the groundwater, and it's basically acid.
Yeah, we talked about that earlier. All right, Chris, thanks a lot. Thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, good to hear from you. Lots of emails that I haven't read yet, and I don't know if I can do justice to them. One says, the tailings pile never mentioned is enormous. Bulldozers look like tiny Tonka trucks on top of it. It's a shame, writes Jerome. And then Jeff writes, I think it's just the ageless debate of economic prosperity versus health and safety concerns. It's quite a challenge to find the right balance, writes Jeff. And then Peter writes this regarding extraction fees. He says, why not simply increase extraction fees for all natural resources? Increasing extraction fees for fossil fuels could force them to be more expensive than renewables. Problem solved, right? Writes Peter in Largo. That also is interesting. Peter, thanks for adding that to the conversation. Well, if you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001 or record your comment on extension 115. I'll play those comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Thanks for tuning in to Radioactivity. Jessica Green's been our phone producer today. Coming up in the next hour, the Midpoint Program with NOLA. He'll be here and taking your calls live. Thanks a lot for tuning in to WMNF Tampa, 88.5 FM. We're going to take a break and get the latest news from NPR, and then NOLA will be right back in 5 minutes. So stick around to the news from NPR.